We've heard this story before.
Yes,
For
of
sure.
course.
That's so funny. Not funny. We shed a feminine tear.
Yes.
We'll talk about me for now.
Yeah, sounds good. Because I actually
Welcome back to All Alone with Something to Say. This is your host, Emma Newberry. I'm delighted to welcome you back to the show with an episode that's particularly prescient, I guess, both given our podcast title, but also our current moment, where attacks on healthcare, science, and vital research for Americans' health by the Trump administration and the Make America Healthy Again movement are continued with renewed vigor on what feels like a daily basis, if not hourly. Before we start, for those who haven't seen, we had a logo redesign done by the wonderful textile and found object artist Charlie Dove Shern. Her website is linked in the show notes, and I really recommend checking out her work because a lot of it focuses on ritual, observance, memory, lots of things that this podcast also circles. We landed on this idea of the trout in the logo as sort of, what does it mean to communicate the depth of ourselves from the depths of ourselves? What does it mean to contemplate how our voices carry through the different environments we're in? Can one voice, volleyed farther through the deep, travel far enough to make a ripple for those gazing from the shore? I say yes. And in the spirit of that, the next thing I have for you is a question. What does it really feel like to be tired? How does that word land in your body, or other words you might reach for that might feel like synonyms to you? Exhausted, drained, fatigued. What if one day your definition of that word changed forever and you felt like you were the only one? I'm certainly not the first to explore how language functions differently in American society or gendered notions of what it means to be active or what it means to be passive, but they're ones that we're going to be exploring today in part through examining the larger cultural trends in and reactions to one particular chronic illness. Chronic fatigue syndrome, or myalgic encephalomyelitis, ME. It was also historically called neurasthenia, atypical polio, has been called Gulf War syndrome, Gulf War illness, chronic multisymptom illness, and medically explained chronic multisymptom illness, that's MUCMI, across gender identities and throughout American history starting around the 1800s. It's always touched on anxieties around gendered, particularly feminine agency, productivity, and the capitalist ideal, and the limits of our language in communicating complex chronic experiences, both within the medical community and in society at large. So we have this illness, ME/CFS, that operates often in concert with or can be similar to other conditions like fibromyalgia and long COVID. We have a world driven online through the course of the pandemic. We have a government sowing seeds of mistrust in the very pillars of information dissemination in our country. And we have a society that was constructed with profit as paramount. And if you can manage to play your cards right and get seen and get an appointment, we have an underfunded and often siloed medical research apparatus whose parameters for this disease are as simultaneously vague as they are maddeningly elusive for those looking for diagnosis. In my first draft of this episode, I cast these as cracks in our communities, in our society, for people to fall through. Now, I sort of think the best word to use to capture what sufferers of ME/CFS have shared is a gaping abyss. Today's episode focuses on one woman's experience with ME/CFS, Tally Shea. Tally is a friend from Bowdoin, someone who I know, who not only recently began confronting the overlapping diagnoses that coagulate in the body with this condition we're focusing on today, but one who responded in a uniquely dogged way that allows her to serve as a passionate ambassador for those who feel left to contend with this illness alone. I sat down with Tally to talk to her about her experience over the last year or so as she battles ME/CFS, as well as to try and draw out the larger stories we can uncover that we tell ourselves about what it means to be good, to be productive, to be well, and to be a part of everyday life.
Oh, I haven't had to introduce myself, honestly, other than like in an online Discord group for other sick people that I'm in, that I'm a moderator of, which if you would have asked me if I would have been a mod on Discord, like, I don't know, 2 years ago, I would have been like, no. But I'm Tally Shay. I'm 28 and I'm living in Brooklyn. I'm from Massachusetts. I newly identify as being very chronically ill, and adjusting to living with new abilities and disabilities. I previously worked after college. I went to Bowdoin with Emma, fabulous. And I worked in cybersecurity before. I started at IBM Security, and that's what got me into the cybersecurity field.
When Tally says she got sick, she's referring to the fact that she now lives with ME/CFS, that condition I mentioned earlier. Its full name is a mouthful: myalgic encephalomyelitis, or chronic fatigue syndrome. It's described by the Mayo Clinic as a, quote, chronic neurological disease often preceded by an infection, end quote, and is a constellation, at least for Tally, of interlocking and debilitating symptoms, including dysautonomia, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, known as POTS, mast cell activation syndrome, and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome hypermobility type, which she was born with, all of which emerged as if from the woodwork and have persisted long after the initial infection she experienced, which began as a relatively routine, if stubborn, case of mono in February of 2024.
I had this like drawn out few months where I just felt really fatigued, but like I was living a normal life. And but I kind of was just like, I was stressing because I knew like something wasn't right. And I had some follow-up appointments, like I had some autoimmune markers. And so I started going to a rheumatologist, and I was having a lot of issues with like my pelvic region. Like I have a history of ovarian cysts, hemorrhaging ovarian cysts. And it was causing me a lot of strife and pain. And this was probably the first time I got really upset with our medical system, I would say, because I was just like tossed around and not given a solution. And it wasn't until like by like June, something was wrong. I'm having these crashes that are crisis. There's no other way to put it. There was no stability. I lived alone. I have a dog. I can't take care of myself. I can't go to the grocery store. I remember just sitting with my boyfriend and feeling so awful and so sick, but in this way that I've never felt before and doesn't and didn't like collide or wasn't congruent with our society's understanding of being sick, like acute illness. And we were like eating dinner and it was just so out of it and felt so awful. And I just remember saying to him, like, I don't want to live like this. Like, I can't live like this anymore. I'm like on Reddit. I'm like Googling. I'm like, why am I not recovering from mono? Like, what's going on? And that's the first time that I have a very scary person on Reddit telling me that, like, I have chronic fatigue syndrome or, like, I should read up about it. And when I looked at that Reddit, the absolute terror that came over me when I realized, like, I could have this illness that doesn't go away, people live with for decades, has a 5% prognosis in terms of recovery, like horrible, horrible, scary things. And so that's when I started really diving in.
What does it mean when your bodily experience begins to outpace the words that are available to you around being sick, around rest? The words with certain valences like tired or exhausted, drained, burnt out, fatigued, words that we invoke, at least I do, thoughtlessly, all the time. What does it feel like to be told all of this by a stranger on the internet? Absent the official qualities of the clinical setting, the sterile room that can contain your initial heart-dropping reaction to any life-changing medical news, Tally didn't get that. Whether that's considered truly a deprivation is sort of the other less spoken aloud question. Because Tally's experiences to come with attempting to get doctor's appointments, diagnoses, and even basic questions answered was, and remains, a battle. By the fall, she had left her job, apartment in New York City, and had to move home to Massachusetts to live with her family.
Yeah, I had a really brutal fall and winter, like learning everything, learning what my diagnoses are. And I would say just a lot of like fear, a lot of stress, a lot of tears, a lot of, yeah, I think fear, honestly, I think fear is like the biggest one when I didn't know what my future was going to be. I slowly realized like, okay, I have like tachycardia when I'm standing up, and like all of a sudden I have low blood pressure issues, and like, like all these other people have MCAS and all these illnesses kind of grouped together. Like, do I have this? And like, I've always been hypermobile and blah, blah, blah. Like reflecting on my whole medical history, reading information. I read a lot of research. So I definitely went the science route.
The immediate impression is like, okay, like Tally totally has this under control. Like she knows everything about what's going on with her, but I imagine that's not how it felt, at least at first, and maybe still I don't know how it feels.
Yeah,
but you said you described it as sort of like this cascading thing. Like,
yes,
what was it like to kind of reach the like knowledge points about what actually was happening to you?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and I think you're asking me this at a point where I feel comfortable like talking about everything, and I'm kind of turning a corner in terms of like understanding these diagnoses and also coming to a place of like more peace and acceptance with them, and kind of at my point of like, okay, I'm adjusting now to like living life with them. God, it took me time to get there. And like, I guess the one thing I should note is that like I chased after every doctor appointment I got. Like nothing came to me. Like I went hard in the paint, and I sought information. And so this is honestly a pretty expedited experience for these illnesses. There are so many people that were diagnosed years into their symptoms because of so many different reasons of lack of knowledge, of lack of being believed, of just whatever. Yeah. So I'm very grateful for, even though it was chaotic, I kind of got on board pretty quickly, and have like grown a lot of interest in the medical field, learning everything, learning what my diagnoses are. Let me read everything I can and talk to everyone I can so that I can understand what's going on and also play a proactive role in my recovery, because I don't see a regular schmegular doctor doing anything for me at all. People don't even know what this illness is. So I don't trust anyone to get me better. Like, I'm going to figure this out.
For someone who doesn't have a chronic illness, this kind of distrust or skepticism in the medical community can be unfamiliar, but it's the exact kind of skepticism that people with ME/CFS experience from the medical community as well. And it makes sense, especially when the result for many, like Tally, is returning home with an armful of diagnoses, with very little in the way of treatment and nothing in the way of cure. Moreover, we're touching on anxieties around what it means to be good at being sick in American society, being sick in a way that other people can accept and understand as true. You'll hear in just a moment, and I want to provide a quick content warning here, Tally talking about the rates of medically assisted dying, known as MAID, in those with ME/CFS and similar conditions. In January of 2024, during Tally's discovery phase of her illness, the College of Family Physicians in Canada reported in its publication on what it called Patient Experiences with Requests for Medical Assistance in Dying, which has been legal in Canada after some contention since about 2021. The college interviewed 16 patients who had requested MAID psychological consultations, which are required, through a variety of channels. They spanned the ages of 20 to 60, and they had a variety of illnesses, including ME/CFS, but also fibromyalgia, depression, and chronic pain, all of which often were interlocking in their cases. One patient six, stuck out to me. They live with chronic pain syndrome, traumatic arthritis, and PTSD. And they said, when asked why they sought out the MAID process, I guess the best way of saying it is that the MAID process allowed outside people to look in and see whether or not I was being, you know, honest. Reviewing things, not so much correctly, but practically, and whether or not my decision has been made from being crazy, so to speak, as opposed to being realistic. Patient 6's account highlights the ways in which people are still compelled to search for legitimacy from these social systems, even as the same systems fail them. And it also illustrates the level of damage that lack of belief and trust can enact on people emotionally, especially people who have been historically denied a voice in their own care. The Mayo Clinic reports that ME/CFS disproportionately affects women. And we'll look at some statistics from the CDC in a minute that report that ME/CFS also disproportionately affects Black and Latino populations. Fundamentally, I would argue, this sort of attitude towards ME/CFS is an outgrowth of a larger attitude that we don't have space for that kind of fill-in-the-blank that has a distinctly American flavor, or just white supremacist flavor, maybe. And in this case, I'm saying, of course, that kind of sick. We don't have room for that in our society. The question of whether or not we are equipped as a society to address chronic illnesses that are debilitating to millions of our people is a big one. The answer is no. In March, the Trump administration gutted Columbia's research program into ME/CFS and closed the HHS's office for long COVID research and practice. There's a deeper set of questions, though, that goes beyond those of financial access, current administrational fascism, or other environmental factors that have put such hurdles in the way of progress for ME/CFS research. This is the set that tends to dry up conversation. Are we prepared, in order to truly understand conditions like ME/CFS, to value people beyond their function? To value someone like Tally beyond her identity, as she says, as a
28-year-old was able-bodied and a contributor to the economy, and I am not anymore, so that's something to be said.
Are we equipped to not only treat and research, given the chance, but really to understand the true cost that ME/CFS brings to bear on those who suffer with it? Not just the cost that we incur when they suffer? On the CDC website are listed top facts about ME/CFS for those just getting acquainted. Here they are, in the order they appear, on the site. Anyone can get ME/CFS. In adults, ME/CFS affects more women than men. People who are Black and Latino may be more affected. ME/CFS is most common in people between the ages of 40 and 60. ME/CFS is more common in adolescents than young children. People of all income levels can get ME/CFS. Between 836,000 to 3.3 million people in the US have ME/CFS. I read some of those last statistics to Tally, and this was her reaction.
The dates matter of when those statistics were gathered, because we're looking pre and post pandemic.
Right.
ME/CFS and all these things were a thing long before the pandemic. The pandemic has accelerated and blown up the number of people with ME/CFS presenting long COVID. And there's a lot of research about, like, there are similar dysfunctions going on in the two. So they get grouped together a lot. I would say, I think Yale estimated more like 7 to 9 million Americans with ME/CFS. Yeah.
She's right. Yale Medicine reports that studies over the last few years have found that about half of people with long COVID meet diagnostic criteria for ME/CFS. And the prevalence of ME/CFS has been growing as a result of the pandemic and long COVID. Recent estimates suggest that there may be 3.3 million Americans living with ME/CFS, possibly growing to 5 to 9 million as a result of the pandemic. So Tally, rightfully, is reacting to the facts first, as someone who's living with a chronic illness that is chronically discounted. I noticed that too. And maybe it was the writer in me, but I also found their order to be a fascinating indicator of our cultural attitude toward ME/CFS. Why is the income bracket stat above the wildly large and, we now know, inaccurate statistic about how many people are affected by this disease? Why is it necessary to have the first fact be, almost imploringly, anyone can get ME/CFS? In even these neutral attempts to present the situation, a feat in itself these days, there are these traces of our cultural sheepishness around this illness that only deepens its impact.
Getting diagnosed with a chronic illness, in addition to like an unknown one, in addition to an untreatable one, is a very unique and isolating and horrible experience that, again, we're not going to like, there's no need to, no need for like a misery competition and being like, oh, this, like all illnesses are terrible. Some are terrible in different ways. That, so just point blank there. But yeah, it is awful in its own unique world because it's never ending. You feel helpless and there's no one, it feels like there's no one looking out for you and nothing that can be done. It's just an abysmal, it's like, how does anyone have an okay outlook on this? How does anyone like grapple with this news? Like you have to be so, you'd have such mental fortitude. It's yeah. But also like that whole like, oh, you're so strong. Rhetoric can get really frustrating as well because it's like, well, what choice do I have? That's something I've felt my whole life, just regardless of illness. Like I've had a lot of hard, I've had a bad hand of cards dealt to me. I was like making sure I got the expression right. And I've always been fueled with people telling me like, you're very strong, you're the strongest person I know. And all the time I'm just like, this doesn't make me feel better. I don't know. It's just,
yeah,
it's so, so well intended, but it's like, we don't have an effing choice. What else am I gonna do? I'm just trying to like live with the news I've been given. So yeah.
Yeah. It's a pretty bleak landscape. You're faced with an illness that disproportionately affects disadvantaged populations and often necessitates self-reporting to a medical system that has been designed to discredit, ignore, and harm said populations. Furthermore, you're equipped with a literal and cultural language to describe your symptoms that has been generated from within said historically racist and sexist medical system. So in case it's not clear, let me spell it out for you. ME/CFS is not a choice. If it were a choice, I didn't come across a single patient in all of my research into those seeking treatment who would wish it upon themselves, or even their own worst enemy. Because the isolation of the physical experience of it is only compounded by the isolation one feels when the structure of society, suddenly confounded at where exactly to put you, effectively turns its back.
I think having ME/CFS, a big part of your existence is trying to describe what you are experiencing, and also within the community chatting about like comparing notes here and there. Like, what are you feeling? What am I feeling? We really do get down to splitting hairs between I'm feeling tired, I'm feeling exhausted, I'm feeling sleepy, I'm feeling fatigue. These are all different experiences that are kind of minimized, I feel like, for a normal person, because it's like kind of not a big deal when you have one night that's like bad sleep. Yeah, I'm exhausted. Right. People are burnt out from their jobs and from their social lives, or they just went for a run and their body is tired or whatever. They had a bad night's sleep. I think the key is that you rebound. I think for people with ME/CFS, I would say one of the big, what makes it different is the consequences we face and how the snowball effect that happens. So at a biological level, like at the smallest little cellular level in our body cannot produce the energy it needs to sustain life. So I think when you think about fatigue in terms of that, like physical fatigue, my body at a cellular level is not creating like the ATP that it needs to make my body function like at a resting metabolic rate, right? So I'm like 5'11, like 160 pounds. And I think my resting metabolic rate, I did this recently, like at a testing facility. For me to just exist, it's like, I think like 1,600 calories. And that's me if I was sedentary, just like in bed, not moving, not eating, not anything, right? And so we just take for granted like how much energy it is to exist. And so when you have such little supply, suddenly getting up out of bed and brushing your teeth is Herculean task. Am I saying that right? Yeah. Like all of a sudden, it's like you're using 20% of your energy reserves to go brush your teeth. So I think that when you're talking about fatigue, it's so important for people to get that this is like a relative term and understanding like what is fatigue in relation to energy supplies, like at a scientific level. And yeah, I mentioned like physical fatigue. So that is like the Let's think about what I like experience. I sometimes I wake up and it feels like I was hit by a bus. Like it feels like my body is so dead. I ran a marathon and I was beaten up. Like my muscles are in agony and like everything is stiff and it hurts. And the feeling of like picking up my phone is exhausting. Sometimes my arms are so weak and they're trembling that literally holding my phone up is like, it's too much for me. So that's what we're talking about when we're dealing with fatigue. And I think some people with ME, it gets to a point where can you physically do this? Yes, but you would deal it with consequences. Like you will crash significantly after. And some people are so severe that no, they literally physically can't do it. And I have dance that line at times where it's like I've had to use what's the word accessibility what's the word I'm looking
Like
for
devices or like,
accessibility devices. Like for me specifically, I literally got like a transport chair. Sometimes I can't stand. I mean, part of that has to do with like my dysautonomia. Like my legs are so weak, I need someone to push me around. So yeah, there's like the physical element, but there's also a cognitive fatigue element. I am on the better scale of concentration and cognitive ability. There are some people where that is like their primary issue. I've even witnessed some people in my group where it is like thinking, emotions, like that is, they're done and it crashes them. It's so horrifying. I can't express that enough. But again, I can't exactly say like what are the underlying mechanisms that are like causing this, but at the end of the day, you're like your brain is the largest user of ATP in your body. So, like, cognitive tasks are demanding of our body, and we don't got the gas in our tank. Fatigue at the end of the day is a symptom, right? There's a lot of illnesses that have fatigue as a symptom. It's an experience people feel sometimes on a day-to-day basis, but so different than chronic fatigue syndrome, where there are specific biological breakdowns. It's a multi-systemic issue in the body and something like happening at a cellular level. So we can clear that one up.
Reading from some of the sources you gave me, like the on ME Action, they say people with ME experience a substantial loss of physical and/or cognitive function. The average person with ME scores as more disabled on these quality of life surveys that they use for various things than those with MS, strokes, diabetes, renal failure, lung disease, heart failure, and cancer.
Yes, I'm so glad you read that. That's one of my favorite to bring up to people.
And like, I'm sorry, but my initial reaction was like, no way. And like, I know that that's not right.
I think the key thing to note, and I was told this very early on by an infectious disease doctor that I saw super, super early on. Like, this is during my like discovery phase last year. She was like, by the way, F this lady, kind of, because she just was like completely downplayed the whole thing. Was just like, you're gonna be better by Christmas. Like, they're like, you don't have any active infection, blah, blah, blah. Like, yeah, she wasn't like, you have ME CFS. She was just like, oh, post viral, we don't know much about it. Like, we can't really help you. Sorry, which is all true. But didn't have any accountability for like me getting better. She said like, ME/CFS is not a sexy disease. It's not going to get any funding. People aren't dying. Blank. That was it. She spat it out at me. And honestly, I appreciate the transparency because right away, like, you just, I think this group of people feel so alone, so unhelped. It's really easy to get cynical. And so it's so easy to complain and just be like, no one's doing anything. And like, we're just alone. And all that's so, so true. Like I'm on Instagram out there being like, what the hell? Like, why isn't my government doing anything about this like epidemic essentially? But I also, it was nice to just be told flat out, like, you know what? Sorry. Like, this is just the reality. Like, no need to don't like complain about it. Cause it's just, it's not a sexy disease and it sounds so fucked up, but yeah, no one is dying. Obviously the people with ME, would argue being trapped alone in your room with no stimulus and just your thoughts and sometimes even cognitive exertion is sending you into a crash, that is a hell that is getting up there with not wanting to be like alive. There is a high mental health crisis and like assisted dying uptick with people with ME/CFS, and no problem that you, I'm like nothing to be ashamed of that you were like resistant to understanding that. Yeah, well, I didn't know about ME/CFS before this. Like I didn't take viruses as seriously as I do now. Like there's so much I've learned, so I'm not going to be sitting on some moral high ground. Like it's not our fault that like society hasn't taught us to, I don't know, take this stuff seriously. I have been privileged and blessed with friends and family that want to be there for me and like believe me and all that. And even still, I have felt so alone and so lonely and so like they don't get it. And like I want to like scream like, you don't get it. And like, I have a worse quality of life than this and that. Like, I just, and this is to no blame of like my loved ones. Again, it's so hard to understand something like this until you're like going through it.
So how do we build space in our society for those with this illness? How do we increase our empathy, our understanding of ME/CFS? Perhaps unsurprisingly, it starts with language, how we talk about it.
I feel like maybe like calling it an energy limiting illness is like something I've heard, energy limiting illness. Yeah, let's talk about spoons. And then also I can give the context of like visible and like the whole concept of pacing actually is like really important. So maybe I had mentioned earlier, like there's no cure for ME/CFS and for a lot of chronic illnesses. And so literally some of the best advice we have going on is, unfortunately, the burden of the patient is to pace. And this is kind of universal technique for any energy limiting illness. How that can look different for a disabled or ill individual compared to like your average person on the street. And let's just say that like your average person or I before I was chronically ill had like 100 spoons and or maybe even enough spoons that it almost felt like it's hard to run out.
Yeah. Right.
And now it's essentially just if you have a limited amount of spoons, let's say 10, and the next person could have 5 and the next person could have 3. And so that's different from one person to the next. It's essentially just that any activity you do is using a spoon or two. It has some sort of like quantity to it. And so if you only have 10 spoons and going to take your dog out is using 3 of them, that like you're, and it's 10 a.m. that you're left with 7 spoons for the rest of the day. And you got to make yourself breakfast and quickly you're at 6 spoons. And God forbid you have a job, you know, and like that uses 5 spoons. And then all of a sudden it's like 6 p.m. and you have 1 spoon left and you feel really miserable And how are you going to use that spoon? Are you going to take a shower, or are you going to be able to cook yourself dinner? If you cook yourself dinner, you're probably going into a spoon deficit, and that's where a lot of like these symptoms present themselves. And you bleed into the next day of having like a spoon deficit, and so maybe that day you literally can't do anything. You need to stay in bed. This is kind of similar to, so the Visible is like the armband pacing app I use, and yeah, they're all about like pacing your energy, and so they visualize that through like graph data, continuous heart rate monitoring, and they have branded it as like pace points. And so like I, for example, had like 10 pace points for a day, and so I could understand via my like heart rate, and some people use like steps on their I have Fitbit as well, like getting an idea of like how much energy you're using. So that's the rough spoon theory, the rough pacing theory. But I think that this illness is about bargaining, and it's about making choices. There's just so much planning, so much buffering. A lot of people do like preemptive rest, post rest, so like sandwiching activities, doing stuff and knowing there'll be consequences later. And you just kind of look at life differently. For a long time, there wasn't, it really felt like there wasn't anything good in my life. I said that to my boyfriend many times, where I was just like, I don't have much going for me right now. Like, I've lost my job. I've lost my social life. I can't take care of my dog. I can't do my hobbies. Like, I used to exercise a lot. I used to do pottery. I've literally left my whole world in New York. I'm home, like I'm alone and with my family, which love them, but stressful. So me moving back to New York was definitely a big, massive challenge, but it has brought so much life back in for me. So yeah, things were very grim. I think the smallest of things, like I would seek them out to bring me joy, like being outside, audiobooks. I have committed my life to two different audio or book series. Reading was definitely a really big thing for me that even to this day like is a lifeline for me. In terms of social life, like really that is hard because people want to be there for you when you are sick, and it's like I can't be around you. I can't socialize. Like, I don't have the energy to socialize. I don't feel well enough to socialize. This wouldn't even be enjoyable. So there were a lot of moments for me where I was with people and I was miserable. And it's like, these are my dear loved people, but like I'm suffering. And then I feel so weird structuring, like being like, all right, like I'm sorry, I need you to leave. Like, I don't feel good. I don't know that maybe this is part of being a woman. Maybe it's part of my personality, but maybe it's just social grace. But you have to learn to socialize in a different way. So that's when you're actually seeing people. Then you're navigating, like, all people want to talk about is like your illness, and like that's exhausting to be updating people all the time. There's not a lot of like, I mean, I think everyone can handle it differently, but sometimes you just want to be like a normal girl and chat about this and that. I like pin my friends down for tea a lot. I'm like, what's going on? What did you wear? Can I have pictures? Like, I miss that part of life a lot. And again, like I'm dipping my toe back into that, but looking back at the year I've had, and then also just a lot of heartbreak. My friends are losing me in ways. My family is losing me in ways. My boyfriend's losing me in ways. My dog's losing me. I have I don't want to say gotten better, because it's like, who's good at being sick? But like, I've adapted and kind of turned a corner. I kind of mentioned this in the beginning in terms of like learning and adapting to being with this illness. And so I think that's given me like a little bit more room. There's an endless world of looking for what's wrong in me. I have gone to every type of doctor. I have done so much research. Like, you're so afraid of like, well, what if this one weird thing that I need to get imaging done is like causing me this, and I could get an improvement in my quality of life, blah 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 blah. That could go on literally forever. So you kind of also, I am learning how to put stuff in the back burner, spread stuff out, think about what's really needs to get done, and maybe pause on some other stuff, and also like try and like enjoy life. But these days, like, I have seen friends, I've had visitors. I even went to my first social gathering like out last weekend. There was an outdoor dinner, which felt good for me for like COVID safe reasons. And it was like a bunch of girls and I was super nervous to go, but like I felt good enough to go try it out. And I felt good there. I felt like death when I got home and the next day, but it was worth it. And it just felt so good to like laugh and like chat with people and like wear a cute outfit and like put on makeup. And that was so wonderful, but also super foreign. I literally created I started a new hobby for my illness. And my illness hobby is I was like, I need something sedentary that gives me, fuels my heart and my soul. And I learned to crochet. God, I love it. Again, sometimes my arms are so weak, I'm trembling so bad, like I can't. But when I'm feeling good, it's such a pleasure to like make things for people.
Because it's also like a way of caretaking for your people too.
Yes, I love to do other things for people, and that's a love language of mine. It's like making things for them and giving things for them. And you lose so much identity when you become disabled and sick. And so much of my identity was intermingled with what I can do and what I can do for other people and be there for other people.
Tally works to weave her own new language of care, of what she can do. And though the overarching tide can feel like one of apathy, there are small eddies that have helped Tally feel held.
I have friends that are so supportive, and I'm going to shout out Allie. Like, my friend Allie is literally running the New York Marathon for like a rare chronic disease, and specifically for ME/CFS. And I guess last year there was someone that ran for it. So that's amazing. Doing any opportunity I can like this to talk about it and get it shared on like a platform. I think talking about it, writing, and like interpersonal interaction is like a big form of advocacy for me. And honestly, I think if I come out of this, you know, I'll never be the same, and that's okay. If I get to a more, if I expand my energy envelope one day, like I think I'll use a lot of these lessons. And I think that any healthy individual could benefit from a lot of these lessons.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. For more information on ME/CFS and to donate to Allie Williams' run through the National Organization for Rare Diseases, please see our show notes.